Tonight, we're honored to have Christian J. Pinto, filmmaker, producer of Megiddo 2, and of course, America's Secret Destiny, The New Atlantis. We're going to be talking with Chris about some of the New Age voices of darkness, Blavatsky, Bailey, and some of the Masonry and some others. So we think this will be a very fascinating interview with Chris Pinto. New Age voices of darkness, Blavatsky, Bailey, and Masonry. So we'll kind of start out a little bit talking about one of your wonderful videos, Megiddo 2. And, of course, we have talked before on air about elements of it. We had talked about the Spiritism, the Fox Sisters. And let's move right up to the effect of Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy, Chris, if you would like to take it from there.
Oh, sure. Madame Blavatsky is probably, when you think of the term the New Age, her name is probably the most notorious. She considered herself the kind of the Apostle Paul for the New Age movement. What had happened in America, in the West, with the Fox Sisters movement, was this whole spiritist movement had opened up. There had been hints of it, certainly. I mean, I'm sure that there was spirit-related activity where there was channeling going on and automatic writing. We write about a guy, or we talk about a guy in Megiddo 2 called Emanuel Swedenborg, who had lived a century prior. And he was known as the man who talked with angels because he channeled all of these demonic spirits and entities and then wrote down the things that they told him. And we find all of the elements of the New Age movement there. Prior to that, in the during the Elizabethan era, you study about Dr. John Dee and Edward Kelly, who openly channeled demonic spirits and, you know, angels, as they called them. But they admitted that some of them, even they themselves admitted that some of these angels who denied the gospel were demonic powers. So this had been going on in the West for a while. But with the Fox Sisters movement in 1848, that was seen as sort of the kickoff event that really shook the whole country here in America at that time. And that's believed by many to have been the event that opened the door, if you will, to the modern spiritual movement. And from there, you know, you had all of this kind of, you know, channeling and supernatural stage events and things, and people like Andrew Jackson Davis, who would give live presentations where he would channel spirits and, you know, communicate with the audience and this kind of thing. You had famous people like Edgar Allan Poe that would go to these shows and presentations and so on. And so people were really fascinated with it, but they didn't quite know what to make of it. So along comes Madame Blavatsky, and she considered herself, the reason I call her the Apostle Paul of the New Age movement, is if you study the letters of Paul, Paul's going around to all the different churches, and he's giving them instructions on how to understand the doctrine of the New Covenant throughout. And telling him, you know, what to do, what not to do, talking about issues like circumcision and so on, and really setting down the guidelines for the churches. Well, Blavatsky believed it was her mission to do the same thing for the New Age movement. She saw all of this spiritual activity going on, you know, these strange rappings and this kind of thing, and she earnestly believed that all of this activity needed to be formalized into a method of doctrine that people would understand, and that they would have guidelines, do's and don'ts, about what you do and you don't do as an occultist dealing with the New Age. And so that's what her Theosophical Society was all about. It was about instituting and setting forth a system of understanding for contact with the occult realm and how it should be understood. And she openly admitted, you know, that if it was handled properly, she said, then it could, you know, there could be great benefits, but if not, there were many dangers, you know, and so on. And so this is what her Theosophical Society was all about. And Blavatsky actually, she believed in a a prophecy that was a centuries-old prophecy that was believed on by other occultists like Albert Pike in what is known as the 1881 prophecy. That year was believed to be the a year that had been set forth centuries prior, and that year was going to mark the beginning of a new era for mankind, that an old era was going to, you know, at that point was going to die out, and a new era was going to spring forth. And in the,
and where did that prophecy originate?
That originated from the ancient world. In fact, I've got a reference volume here. It begins with a guy named Trithemius, who was writing about the 15th and 16th century.
Was he probably Greek?
I don't know if he was Greek, but he was very definitely involved in the occult. And he believed he would write from a Christian perspective. And Trithemius believed in mixing Christianity and magic. They believed that this was something that was, you know, an acceptable thing to do. David Ovison writes about this 1881 prophecy, and how it was believed on by many occultists as marking the beginning of a new age, as kind of the dawning of a new age. And depending upon where, you know, who you talk to, for example, you can go back and you can read about Francis Bacon. And we talk about it in another one of our documentaries, how Francis Bacon believed that he was the herald of a new age.
Yes, and I think we should tell the listeners right now that that DVD is available at RBN Live. Let's give the name of it again, Chris.
It's Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, Volume 1, The New Atlantis.
And I believe you'll soon be at work on Part 2.
In fact, we are at work on Part 2 right now, and Part 2 deals with the secret architecture of Washington, D.C., and a lot of the esoteric symbolism, if you will, that's found in that city and where it comes from and so on. In fact, we're planning a trip to Washington next month to do the filming there.
Well, I believe that will be very, very integral and very fascinating. And also, while we're talking about sources for your wonderful material, Megiddo 2 and Megiddo 1 are both available at Dr. Stan Monteith, RadioLiberty.com. And that telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. Again, I urge you, if you can only get one video from anywhere this year, get Megiddo 2. It's superb. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, Chris, let's get back to this prophecy that was supposed to culminate in 1881.
Well, it really kind of began in 1881. It's a rather involved and complicated prophecy involving the Archangel Michael and all this other kind of stuff.
I misunderstood. So it was really to begin in that year and then culminate more in our day.
Right. It was 1881 was to mark the beginning of it. From what it sounds like, it's to mark the official beginning of the new age, if you will.
And Chris was talking about 1881, an old prophecy that said that would be the beginning of the unfolding of the new age. And that was interesting to me, Chris, because I'm here looking at a book, One World, by Tara Brook. And this is an excellent book that is also available at Dr. Stanley Monteith, Radio Liberty. It pulls together so many strands, the environmentalism, the political scene, the big banking interest. So much is in this book. And I'd like to read a little bit from the book about 1893. Now, this is interesting. As the prophecy began to unfold, one key early event which took place in Chicago in 1893 was the World Parliament of Religions, attracting 140,000 people. The speakers included Buddhist monks, theosophists, Shintoists, a token number of Christian modernists in search of a new ecumenism, plus several highly persuasive mystics. It was the mystics who stole the hearts of the audience. And of course, there Tallbrook goes on to talk about Vivekananda, who was the representative, the disciple of Ramakrishna Paramahansa, who had recently died in India. And Brooks says, even today, the radiant face of Ramakrishna appears on Indian postage stamps, for he occupies a position of renown as great as that of Gandhi. He is considered one of India's greatest enlightened God-men. At the time of the World Parliament of Religions, the spiritual force of Ramakrishna was lighting up India like lightning flashing across a night sky. The ancient gods of India were having a revival through their instrument. Ramakrishna's 12 top disciples were spreading his life story and teachings all over the land. With Vivekananda, the premier disciple, this revival of Indian mysticism was now reaching the West. Vivekananda was an inspired orator whose pleas for unity became irresistible to the thousands attending the World Parliament of Religions. Anyone who condemned the spiritual treasures of this noble figure from the East was simply exhibiting those narrow-minded biases typical of Western Christian culture. One can almost hear the accusations of cultural chauvinism. Take note, here began the early traces of today's common cultural anthropological argument, which defines different religions as being universal spiritual truth, filtered through variant grids of culture and tradition. Spiritual truth could now be seen as wearing the clothing of a given culture's language and imagery. So what the world needed were religious pundits acting as transcultural interpreters of religion. Open-mindedness became a key word. Vivekananda had been a law student when he became enraptured with his guru. Now he was a swami in an ochre robe. His command of rhetoric, apparent nobility, and virtue of character won his case time and again. His key admonition was, all roads lead to God. Does that sound a little familiar, Chris?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that World Parliament of Religions, that's definitely, you know, part of what the Blavatsky and this whole theosophical society were about. In fact, in the year 1881, just going back to that prophecy again, there was held the General Council of Theosophy, which Blavatsky had been the founder, held in 1881, that had formulated the notion that their organization was, quote, to become the nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity. And so that's sort of the argument. That's how they presented, you know, this whole ecumenical focus, was the idea of focusing on this universal brotherhood of all mankind. And how can we embrace all men? Well, the way to embrace all men is to tear down any boundaries that divide men. And the chief boundary of division, of course, is religion. That, you know, men holding different views about who God is often separate from each other and are divided. And, of course, there are other boundaries, political boundaries, racial boundaries, and so on, that have, you know, that we've seen coming down through the 20th century through, you know, various philosophies and doctrines and teachings that are being taught to reunify mankind, to sort of undo what God did at the Tower of Babel, dividing the nations, scattering their languages, changing their languages, and then dividing them throughout the earth. And it's sort of it's the reverse of what God had done to discipline mankind, so that, as the Bible says, they might seek the Lord and feel after him, though he is not far from every one of us, as Paul told the Athenians.
Very interesting, Chris, because that is the Masonic ideal, the brotherhood of man, and this all ties in together, because tonight we're really titling this something like the Dark Prophets of the New Age, Blavatsky, Bailey, and Masonry. Now, looking into William Schneblin's book, Masonry Beyond the Light, it's something interesting in chapter 19. He says, the list of occultists and witches in the last century who were Freemasons reads like a who's who of 20th century occultism. And I'd like to just give his little list. If we run out of time, I'll continue after we come back from the break. Arthur Edward Waite, occult writer and Masonic historian. Dr. Wynn Westcott, member of the Societas Rosicruciana, that would be the Rosicrucian Society in Anglia, and founding member of the occult Order of the Golden Dawn. We know, I believe he was part of the Bible translating of the new translation. Witchcraft, masonry, theosophy. Maybe these things are all connected. This is Elizabeth Border. We're talking with Chris J. Pinto, and I'm reading a list from Bill Snublin's book, Masonry Beyond the Light, and he's giving the list of people who were Freemasons and into 20th century occultism. We had Arthur Edward Waite, Dr. Wynne Westcott. Now we have S.L. McGregor Mathers, co-founder of the Golden Dawn, another secret society. Aleister Crowley, and I'm sure Chris Pinto will have something to say about Aleister. Satanist of this century and founder of the Antichrist religion of Palema. Dr. Gerard Nkosi, masterful teacher, author, teacher of the Tarot, and leader of the occult Martinistas Society. Dr. Theodore Russ, head of the OTO, a German occult satanic society, which made Crowley its head for the British Isles. George Pickengill, the master warlock, male witch of 19th century England, leader of the Pickengill Coven. Annie Besant, leader of the occult Theosophical Society and co-Masonic hierarch. Yes, there are female Masons. Alice Bailey, founder of the New Age organization Lucis, formerly Lucifer Trust. And I might just point out there that the chronology is Madame Blavatsky, then Annie Besant after her, following her, and then Alice Bailey and her husband Foster. But now, on the list, Bishop C.W. Ledbetter, theosophist, mentor to the failed New Age Christ Krishnamurti, and prelate in the occult liberal Catholic Church. Manly P. Hall, and a lot of you have heard of him, the Freemason, Rosicrucian adept, author, founder of the Philosophical Research Society. Gerald B. Gardner, founder of the modern Wiccan White Witchcraft Revival. Alexander, self-styled King of the Witches in London, and one of the most influential leaders of Wicca after Gardner. This might be a moment where we just comment, your video, Megiddo 2, goes into Aleister Crowley, and maybe, Chris, you would fill some of the listeners in who may not have heard of him.
Well, Crowley was, he's probably the most nefarious and highly respected Satanist and occultist of the 20th century. Just because Crowley, if you read his writings, he really, not only was he a very demented and evil individual, but he searched into the deep levels of ancient forms of magic and witchcraft and things like that, and wasn't afraid to do, the darkest and most wicked ceremonies imaginable, things that I wouldn't repeat on the radio, but just horrible things. And he, Crowley's history in a nutshell was that he had actually been the son of Plymouth Brethren. His mother and his father were, devout Christian couple, supposedly. But Crowley was such a little rebel that his mother called him the Beast when she was a child. Used to call him the Beast. And the name stuck. And then his father died when he was about 11 years old and left him a great fortune of money. And he took his father's inheritance and used it to become a debauch and a very, evil, wicked man who just spent his time getting drunk and getting high on drugs and delving into, curiosities of magic and the occult. And he wrote a number of books that didn't sell very well and so on. But he had been influenced by a guy named Francois Rabelais, who was a heretic priest in about the 1400s, 14 or 1500s. And Rabelais had written a series of books called Gargantua and Pantagruel, where he mocked religion, and he wrote about this place called the Abbey Thelema. And Crowley picked up on this idea of the Abbey Thelema, and in the Abbey Thelema there was just one rule, and that rule was do what you will, or do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And so Crowley picked up on this phrase, and it was channeled to him through his first wife, a woman named Rose. And when they were in, I believe they were in Cairo, and they had gone to see this Egyptian exhibit. And Crowley writes about this in his most famous work, something called The Book of the Law. And it was channeled through his wife, Rose, to him, and he, Crowley, wrote down all these notes that this demonic spirit was telling him, which he later identified as Iwas. And basically there were 3 one-hour sessions, and the principal statement of this spirit when talking to Crowley was, "Do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law." This repetition of Rabelais' doctrine. And so Crowley had purchased a place in Sicily, that he called the Abbey Thelema. He named it after Rabelais' fictional location. And there he, in Sicily, he held all of these bizarre rituals and so on. And he had hired this young man to be his secretary, an Englishman, who came there with his wife. And they came there thinking that Crowley was like this eccentric, you know, wealthy Englishman or whatnot. And then they got there, and Crowley wanted them to take part in all of these awful satanic rituals that he was performing. And the couple didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to get out of it. So in one of these rituals, apparently, Crowley made this young man drink cat's blood, okay, as part of this bizarre ritual. And he ended up falling ill, and he died. And his wife escaped, you know, this Abbey Thelema, and went back to London and shared her story of all the horrors that had happened and how her husband had died and so on. And the London newspapers published this throughout London, and Crowley was known as the Great Beast, and he was known as the wickedest man in the world.
Now, after that, one would have thought he would have been prosecuted for murder, but did nothing happen?
Apparently not. He was driven out of Italy or Sicily by Mussolini when Mussolini came to power. Yeah,
he was so bad that even Mussolini.
Exactly. You know, Mussolini. You know you're bad
when
a guy like Mussolini
goodbye.
Kicks you out. But Crowley, you know, sadly was very he was very proud of that title, the wickedest man on earth.
And I believe there are some stories that he may have killed his children.
That could be the case. I know that at least one of his daughters, if I remember correctly, died. But I'm not sure if that was I've never read anything that was part of a ritual, but it wouldn't surprise me if it were. I mean, Crowley admitted to, in his writings, to taking part in child sacrifices and things like that.
Now, I think it's very important that people listening who have never heard any of this before realize that there is a very dark door. Once a little innocuous door is opened into the occult, perhaps someone plays around with a Ouija board, someone reads Sylvia Brown's books, and thinks, well, I can summon up spirits, there's nothing to it. We have to realize, when you were talking earlier about Crowley and the channeling, all of these figures that are these heads of these movements, like the Theosophy, they had the channeling. And I'd like to quote here, first of all, about Blavatsky. This, again, comes from Tall Brooks' book, One World. Blavatsky spoke about her master, and this would be the spirit whom she was channeling, in a letter, quote, "All I can say is that someone positively inspires me. More than this, someone enters me. It is not I who talk and write. It is something within me that thinks and writes for me. I have become a sort of storehouse for somebody else's knowledge. Someone comes and envelops me as a misty cloud and all at once pushes me out of myself. And then I am not I anymore, but someone else." And as I read this to you, Chris, what came to me when I was sitting there during the break, I was scanning through Bill Schneblin's book, Masonry Beyond the Light. And, of course, Bill was saved by our Lord after a Christian woman praying for him. And in the book, he was telling about 4 steps in which people would get more deeply involved with Satan until the fifth step, which was called union. Now, in the fourth step, they were freely channeling to a large extent, and the fifth step would be total possession. And Bill states that through the grace and mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ, he was not permitted to go into step five, and he wonders whether people who've gone that far really, whether salvation would reach them, though he knows God can do anything. But this is the interesting part. He said that in step four, when he allowed these demonic presences to come and he freely summoned them, that it would be as though his whole body was enlarging and taking them in. And he said that once his wife witnessed this, that actually it became so uncomfortable that he expanded so much that I think his clothes, the seams in his clothes, ripped. So that this could be seen as something objective. It wasn't just something he imagined. His wife saw this. Isn't that something?
Yeah, very, very strange.
And so, you know, in talking there about Blavatsky being taken over, then Alice Bailey, her follower, she talked to, I'm quoting again Tall Brooks' One World, both Annie Besant and Alice Bailey, like Blavatsky, claimed to be channels for a number of ascended masters, including the Tibetan, or am I pronouncing this right, Jawal Kool?
Jawal Kool, yeah, Master DK, as he's called by others.
And Alice Bailey knew she had been marked for a task. There is no greater way to increase feelings of self-worth than to feel you have been chosen for a major cosmic task. And I think here's a little humor from Tallbrook. She might have secretly gloated that she was now light years ahead of her better-looking sister. The same entity entered Alice Bailey's life in seven-year intervals. It was not until 1915, when she was 35, that she finally discovered that this turbaned visitor was Master Kuchumi. In 1915, in Lucknow, India, Bailey was close to a mental breakdown from overwork and mental exhaustion. Then Master Kuchumi appeared. Suddenly, a broad shaft of brilliant light struck my room, and the voice of the Master who had come to me when I was 15 spoke to me. He told me not to be unduly troubled, that I had been under observation and was doing what he wanted me to do. He told me that things were planned and that the life work which he had earlier outlined to me would start, but in a way which I would not recognize. In 1919, two things happened to Alice Bailey. She met her first husband, Foster Bailey, an officer in the Theosophical Society, and she met her highest Tibetan master, known as the Tibetan, or Jawal Kool. The Tibetan, according to Bailey, was to be the true author of her many books. It was her moment to enter the world stage. How could she say no? Little did Alice Bailey know at the time that the organization which she and her husband would eventually found would be in United Nations Plaza in New York City by the 1980s, and that the plan dictated to her by the Tibetan would be something held up by world leaders of the New Age movement as the most comprehensive overview of the New Age agenda. So in your video, Megiddo 2, I think some of the most stunning footage is that of Jay-Z Knight channeling up, who was he, Ramtha?
Ramtha, yeah.
Do you want to comment about that a little bit, Chris?
Oh, well, we show Jay-Z, we show a series of channelers. The reason we show Jay-Z Knight, who was featured, there was a documentary that came out, I think about a year ago, called What the Bleep Do We Know? And it was on, you know, supposedly the origins of life and where does man come from and all this other kind of stuff. And they interviewed a bunch of pseudo-intellectual, you know, physicists and professors and people like that. And among all of these, you know, highly accredited academics is Jay-Z Knight. And they don't even call her Jay-Z Knight. They just called her Ramtha, which was very, very bizarre. I didn't see the whole documentary, but from what I saw of it, it was... She looked darker and more evil than I've ever seen her, and she's there giving this philosophical advice on, you know, how to live and all this kind of stuff. But we show Jay-Z Knight because she's the, you know, first of all, because a lot of her her teachings and so on are on videotape, and she has these seminars that she holds, where, you know, you have all the hundreds and thousands of people that show up to get to watch her channel this demonic spirit that calls itself Ramtha. And basically, you know, Ramtha teaches all the principles of the New Age movement, you know, that that you are your own God, and because you're a God, there's no sin, because gods don't sin, you know, so you can't be wrong, and there's no such thing as death, and you're just, you know, reincarnating over and over and over again, and you will be, you know, for thousands of years and so on, and this kind of thing. And it's something that seems almost, you know, when you read about it on paper, it seems almost too incredible to believe. And part of the reason why I wanted to show Jay-Z Knight in person is because I wanted people to recognize these people really are out there. And the principles that they're teaching, there's like a universal mind that goes behind these teachings. We show a series of them in the ghetto, too.
Really, one video picture is worth thousands of words. Just looking at her, there's no way you couldn't see very clearly what you're saying, that universal mind, that evil, demonic presence coming through.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the, I wouldn't even call it a criticism, but one of the comments that is the most profound to me on the Ghetto 2 comes from people who have come out of that movement. And they say, I've had this happen a number of times, they have said when they see Megiddo 2, they can't watch it. And there's this one woman who was actually really liked Megiddo 1. When she saw Megiddo 2, she was an older lady, she said, you know, I watch it, but you know what, I just couldn't watch it all the way through. I asked her why, and she said, no, you know, I think you're, you know, I like the work that you're doing, but that was, it brought back too many memories for her.
That's really understandable, isn't it?
Yeah, some people who are on the outside, the reason I say that, when some people see these channelers, channeling spirits, they think it almost looks a little bit goofy, and it does. You know, somehow or other these guys show up with a bad British accent over and over and over again, and that seems to be the chosen, you know, voice of the channeled spirit. But for people who went through that movement and have come out of it, they know how real it is. They know how dark it is.
That's right. And they don't want to get sucked back into it.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's where this information, you know, becomes very, very telling and very significant when you begin to recognize how people like Blavatsky and Crowley and others have influenced our modern times, and people that we all know of have been influenced quite often by the teachings of these people. So even if you're not familiar with them, you will know those who have been influenced by them. I mean, Alice Bailey, for example, in her writings, greatly influences the United Nations in ways
yes.
that many people don't realize. And that's something that there's a lot of... in fact, I recently, when we went to New York a few weeks ago, went to the UN building and was able to shoot a lot of footage there. And it's just amazing how forward this One World New Age movement is. When you actually go to that building and you see the different carvings and statues that they've got there, it's, seeing really is believing. You can read about it or people can tell you about it, but when you go there, it's very, very plain. This movement really is happening.
Well, totalitarianism comes through spiritual tyranny as well as political tyranny, does it not?
Oh, it certainly does. And that's where all of this is headed, ultimately. We believe in Bible prophecy. We believe that this one-world system is something that God has foretold in the Bible. But in the Bible, we know that it takes a very sharp and a very dark turn at some point, and amounts to a time of tribulation, as Jesus said, such as never been seen upon the earth before, and never will be again. So it's definitely, and the steps along the way, we've seen World War I, World War II, all of these conflicts, the spread of communism and so on, throughout the world in the 20th century, there are many, many calamities that have happened along the way to men and women and children. while this movement has been gaining momentum.
And your video shows that very dramatically and powerfully. It's a very powerful video. I believe that it's a video that's spiritually necessary for most people who are thinking people who are really wanting to know the truth to have. And I say that from the greatest sincerity in my heart, that if I could only have one video, that would be the video. So I really urge those listeners to get Megiddo 2. And Chris, it's been a fascinating hour, and we look forward to talking to you.